Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 126, where Laura, Tom, and our special guest Zach Tan are discussing Harry Braverman's 1974 book, Labor and Monopoly Capital, The Degradation of Work in the 20th Century, originally published by New York University Press, also available in a 25th anniversary edition by Monthly Review Press. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
Something that came to mind over the break was this experience that Laura pointed out, right, of this insecurity. And we really see that in discussions, I think, about the gig economy and the experience of precarity.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I was thinking back to the times when I was interviewing gig workers in Singapore prior to my PhD. And question that was always asked was, why are you doing this work in some form or another? That question was asked. And there's a variety of reasons, from, oh, I've retired and this is how I spend my time. Or others would be like, well, no, this is the only job I can get. And that question, I think, is important to note that it's always asked in relation to, like, why do you put up with so much, like, algorithmic control, right? And the responses of like, well, you know, it doesn't really matter for me. I'm retired. This is something I do in my spare time. To, no, I actually do. I just have to suck it up and put up a bit because this is the only way I can make a sort of living wage. I think those range of responses are themselves kind of interesting in pointing out maybe like a contemporary inflection of digitally mediated work. And that in contrast, I suppose, to the labor processes that Braverman was describing, you have so much more range, right, in sort of the backgrounds and experiences of workers. And that means that sort of for those workers who are really the most vulnerable and they face the most insecurity, that might even make it harder for solidarity to emerge.
Yeah, there's a paper by Jeffrey Salas and Juliet Shore that looks at people who are driving for these ride-hailing companies and tries to understand their different motivations for doing it and tries to understand why people, as you were saying, acquiesce to this very constrictive algorithmic management. And they sort of argue for bringing class back into our understanding by saying there's actually very different types of workers on this platform and they're doing it for different kinds of reasons. And as a result, they have different levels of not resistance, but maybe resentment towards this invasive control, right? And that people are doing it because they have no other option. They don't feel good about the working conditions, but people who are doing it as a way of sort of supplementing their income and maintaining a certain quality of life, they have space to feel like they are maintaining their autonomy even within this constrictive managerial relationship. So I think it's, you know, it's very consistent with what you're arguing. And I think where Braverman is pushing us to see commonalities across classes of workers, we in fact see those classes being sort of reinscribed within some of these contexts that are hiring very different kinds of workers to do similarly sort of surveilled and controlled kinds of work.
It is an interesting question with the gig economy. We do have a couple of episodes that cover it from different angles. And I think maybe that was one of the motivations for getting Braverman onto the list in the first place, was because in those discussions about algorithmic management, we discussed not so much the de-skilling of the work so much as the loss of autonomy. Yeah, the loss of autonomy that the individual gig workers have. But there is also some level of de-skilling that I suppose comes with it, by virtue of the fact that you're not making any decisions about how to get to the customer or what it is that you're doing. You are just simply a automaton following prescribed directions. Is that kind of a fair statement?
I think so. And particularly with digitally mediated work on like labor platforms, right? The replaceability of workers is so prevalent, right? The idea that you could, if you had, let's say, a transcription task to do, the idea that you could find a worker in sort of any part of the world with access to the internet to do that job for oftentimes a lower wage than workers in your sort of local context might agree to, I think it is also a very big influence in sort of this race to the bottom effect that I think others have noted about digital platforms mediating work.
Mm-hmm. I guess my question would be, though, is the level of de-skilling or degradation felt equally? Do we interpret Braverman as kind of like making this sound like this is felt universally, and therefore we should see some sort of like a universal or common reaction or resistance against it? Or is it in practice the experience so varied, maybe by occupation, maybe by context or whatever, that maybe the differences in how people feel about their work has prevented this common resistance? I'm just kind of wondering what you think about that.
I mean, I certainly don't think that it's being felt equally. I think his argument is that it's being felt almost universally, but the way it manifests sort of depends on the technology and organization of work, right? So that was my interpretation, that it was a universal phenomenon for workers, but the manifestation would always vary by workplace, by occupation, and of course by technology and over time. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious to hear Zach's interpretation. I also wanted to hear Zach about, you know, which of these occupational shifts are most interesting to you and are things that you're picking up in your work, and how do you perhaps see these dynamics at play in the context you're interested in studying?
Yeah, Laura, I think I completely agree with what you're saying. And I think we see that play out particularly in decisions being made about what kinds of work are being offshored, that this is a universal sort of experience or phenomena, but the manifestations are different. And that logic, I think, at least for me, comes through in looking at what kind of decisions about what kind of work is offshore, especially in situations where maybe that particular instantiation of work is less attractive to for local workers being sort of that driving force. But I think in terms of like specific occupations or forms or arrangements of work, sort of what are the limits of pushing this idea, right? This Babbage principle, right? Across sort of occupations that we see today. And in particular, I'm sort of referring to this dynamic, especially with regards to technology, about how it can increasingly become so complex, but also paired with less and less involvement of like the human in these systems or these processes. And I'd be curious to hear about how it might apply in particular to algorithmic decision making, or at least situations where the authority to make decisions becomes increasingly located in some kind of technical system, right? Insofar that it is not just the sort of separation of planning for managers and execution of work in the workers, but certain aspects of planning are themselves subsumed by technologies.
Yeah.
I'm curious, I think, because there's a lot of discussion about human AI collaborations, and in particular, one of the more popular forms that takes as a safeguard is this idea of human in the loop, right? Where you might have like algorithmic decision-making tool, but a human in the loop means that there's someone at the end to either like accept or reject an outcome from that. But actually, I was wondering about sort of in the context of reading Braverman, whether that actually represents, right, the diminishing of that person's skill, because it is, while I think the understanding of the sort of human in the loop is that like, no, the human oversight is important, doesn't it also imply that actually the human involvement throughout the whole process is ultimately diminished?
Absolutely. And this is something that I try and raise in my classes, where I ask students, you know, I teach at a school of management, so I'm teaching people who aim to be managers, and I talk to them about how AI is likely to affect their jobs. And I asked them also how they intend to insulate themselves from the negative effects of automation, right? Precisely the kinds of effects that Braverman lays out, which I do think we should talk about it more, but I do think AI is novel in being able to automate a yet new type of skill, right? We all, new technologies can always automate new kinds of skills. And this is tackling a new set today, but it's a set that's particularly important to this group that I'm talking to, right? Future managers. So I asked them, you know, how they intend to insulate themselves from the negative effects of automation through artificial intelligence. And typically they say, I'm going to learn how to use AI better than the next guy, right? Mm-hmm. I will be more effective at using this new tool. Now, of course, what that means is for the same level of work that needs to be performed by the company, a smaller number of people can do the job, right? If they're leveraging AI to become more efficient, then you need fewer of them, unless you can generate more work, which may in fact sort of come down the line, but it'll take a couple of years. And so there is this sort of experience of precarity sort of that's rising up through ever more classes of workers, right? There's going to be, at least until we can identify new economic opportunities, there's going to be fewer managers needed if all the managers know how to leverage AI to automate part of their job. So I think it's absolutely true that human in the loop means both that the human is doing less of the work and therefore has control over less of the work, that part of their work is being automated away. And that in turn, what that means is that demand for those workers will fall relative to the supply, and the working conditions can in turn decline in precisely the way he's laying out. So I certainly think that that's what's happening. And I think we tend to overlook it because AI provides us with the opportunity to feel more efficient in our jobs. But there's this bigger picture in which what's likely happening is precisely the kind of de-skilling that Braverman laid out. Or at least that's how it appears to me. I don't know. Tom, what do you think?
I think exactly the same. I think we are exercising a healthy skepticism or caution about AI too, because we know what the bad sides are, that the technology is still maturing, and there's a lot of things like, hallucinations and some of the other bad outcomes that, you hope that would be overcome as the technology matures. Once it does, it's going to start affecting more and more about decision making. I like to draw in medical examples because this is a really good case where you've got right now somewhat of both the good and the bad of the advancing technology. Bad, of course, is a matter of opinion, but I'm going to take it from my own experiences of dealing with insurance claims and that sort of a thing, where on the downside of the introduction of technology, you end up with the ability of the receptionist or the administrative assistant to properly code the actions so that the payments can be made readily. At one time when those systems were introduced, it was a godsend because you had so many different interpretations about how, a doctor made a diagnosis, gave a treatment and all that sort of thing. And the insurance companies were dealing with all sorts of inconsistent information. And so we created this technology that made it streamlined, consistent, more effective at translating, what services should have been provided into payment. So then the question I have is, when did that goodness turn into insurance companies or the system making the decisions instead? And how do you recognize when that when the goodness became bad? Because I also say the same things now with some of the other things that like with the potential for AI to enhance diagnoses. So if you have a doctor who, for example, is unfamiliar with the rather peculiar, odd patient in front of him or her, then you have the potential ability to consult with an AI tool or some other fashion that can give you a diagnosis that you wouldn't otherwise get. Goodness. At what point do we recognize that perhaps the AI is at the point of maturity where then the doctor ceases to feel comfortable with or just starts yielding their authorities to the AI to make the decisions for them? Last month, we had the Stephen Barley episode on just that very point with the CT scanners and how the CT scanner technologists started to usurp the authority of the radiologists who were chartered with making the diagnoses. Are we going to see a repeat of that as AI matures and then human in the loop becomes human on the loop becomes human out of the loop over time? I'm raising more questions than I am answers, but you know, that's the recognition of the change of the phase is probably something that we're not attuned to, I suppose.
Those are all really complex and great questions. I don't know if I can sort of piece together an answer that touches on all of these, but at least the part that I find most interesting in my work is that a lot of these arrangements of, you know, AI and human work sort of presume a static conception of how people come to develop expertise in their own professions or their own occupations. And I think somewhat neglected is this idea that the effects of sort of these social technical arrangements over time themselves affect the basis through which this expertise is developed, right? I think the medical example is a good one, where particularly in technologies for diagnosis, to help in diagnosis or treatment plans, that sort of presumes that there is a, just going to say, physician at some end who is able to sort of scrutinize the logic through which an output has been generated, right? That scrutiny comes, yes, from formal education, but also the active utilization of those skills, those educations in interpreting cases that they might not have to interpret as the technology matures. So I think looking at the effects on the pathways through which expertise is developed, particularly as it relates to technology over time, is also a really important dimension, I think, that comes up for me in my work a lot.
Yeah, and I think, Zach, I believe you are alluding to the fact that we have a sort of use it or lose it situation with a lot of our expertise, right? Or like, use it or you won't develop it, right? Use it or never get it, where people need to learn to do these things, in essence, unassisted, in order to have the ability to use them effectively. And if they sort of cede that activity to a technology, then it'll be harder for them to maintain a role in managing that technology. Is that the correct interpretation of what you're talking about?
Yes and no. I'm conflicted, or at least I want to give a careful response, because I don't also believe that the only way through which expertise is developed might be, and this, I think, maybe is why I'm worried about, maybe I'm anticipating sort of this frame is during the pandemic, when I entered the labor force prior to the PhD. There's a lot of talk about how much is being lost professionally, right, from not having recent college graduates be in the office. This important skills. And I think an example that was particularly relevant was in like the training of junior lawyers, where like it matters that they are in the office, they learn how to perform sort of routine tasks that you know, they might otherwise feel perhaps too intimidated to ask over email. So on one hand, I think it's sort of a careful distinction needs to be made between this like idea that like the pathways to develop expertise are themselves fixed. But on the other hand, I think it's, Laura, you are like correct in characterizing the worry as kind of what effect does the technological system itself have, right, on this development of a very occupational, very professional basis of expertise itself.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I think it makes sense to be careful to not presume that the path to the cultivation of expertise will remain fixed as it was in the past as we move into the future. At the same time, what the conversation is raising for me is whether we need to think about different actors sort of driving this process. So one of the questions that I wanted to bring into the conversation is whether sort of generative AI is not just whether it's consistent with Braverman's theory, but whether it requires new theoretical elaborations rather than merely an application of the theory. And one of the things that I think is interesting here, although maybe it's consistent with what he laid out in the past, in my reading of Labor Monopoly Capital, it's really management driving this de-skilling process. But But I don't feel like that's necessarily the world in which we are operating today. It seems as though there are both push and pull factors, right? It's not just management sort of pushing workers to automate and rely on automation. It's also workers looking for opportunities to increase their efficiency. So I wonder whether popular adoption of these technologies for fun, for pleasure, for a feeling of mastery, whether that's distinctive or whether it's continuous with what we've seen with prior technological changes and their impacts on de-skilling.
No, that's a great point, because I was also thinking about the we've been talking very much about the workers. There's also the customers' perspectives in this that is driving some of this, because the customers themselves are demanding things faster, better, cheaper, which in turn drives, whether it's management making conscious decisions or if it's just the marketplace driving what constitutes a sellable product, may very well be in contributing to this de-skilling. Because on the one hand, we can say all we want about that we want to have better products, like not cookie cutter off the assembly line type stuff. We would love to have good quality goods. But then if the market or the customers aren't either willing or able to pay the price for that, that sort of cuts, it constrains the whole process, doesn't it?
And I think there is a link here, perhaps, to Breverman's idea of habituation, although perhaps maybe it's a loose one, that on the consumer side, the identification of what is seen as sort of valuable or legitimate from in terms of firms or organizations, it's very much informed by ideas or notions about what is an innovative product, right? What is an innovative organization? And so that is ultimately embedded in this sort of idea of economic and technological progress. And so I think it does inform the way we maybe categorize certain products or services or even organizations, which ultimately leads and feeds back into this sort of idea of it being a self-reinforcing loop.
Now, another thing I wanted to offer as an idea is, because when we're going back to the medical example, now, what happens in an AI-enabled world when you have a significant shift in the paradigm of the expert knowledge, which is to say that what has become embedded is no longer the treatment is invalidated, or in some way a new treatment that is totally divorced from what has been provided before comes into the fore. It's the, you know, what I'm kind of wondering about is, like, if you have this de-skilling to the point where we've ceded our autonomy decision-making to the AI, what then happens when we have to completely and totally retrain the AI? Who and how is that going to happen? What happens if not everybody retrains their AIs? Can you imagine if, one medical corporation decides to not invest in that because it would be too expensive? So the AI is still making decisions that doctors are not trained to catch based on the old way of treating something and ignoring what is the new way. Is that a something that, like, if we take Braverman to his logical conclusion, is something that's going to become a problem?
I think just as a quick comment to add on to what you just said, Tom, is that at least I would intuitively assume that one of the important reasons for the maintenance of local expertise and local expert knowledge is in the identification of appropriate scope conditions for something like the output of an AI. So understanding how things are done, what kind of local conditions might affect an output of like a generative AI system that is trained on a much more general set of information, much more general data set, I suppose. And that was just, I wanted to just quickly comment on that. That is, it's really hard to substitute sort of localized ways of performing work, of doing the work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the healthcare context is a difficult one because the interests of capital in that context are not always aligned with the improvement of service provision, right? Because it's not really like it doesn't operate very efficiently as a market. There's not a lot of competition, or there's substantial frictions, right? And so I think the challenge there is whether the drive from the capitalist perspective is sort of aligned with improving patient outcomes. I think that that's where maybe the challenge might partially arise.
Right. And we are seeing that the doctors who are now in some of these medical service firms who are so restricted on the amount of time that they're allowed per patient, that some of the ways in which those capitalist thought processes are entering into the medical field is creating great tensions because it's sort of pushing the professionals to behave more algorithmically, which then creates some degree of concerns about patient outcomes. It's like what Andrew Abbott would have called a form of deprofessionalization, which is one of the things that we have also discussed in a previous episode. And the more that that happens, of course, that raises questions about conflict between what the customer expects, in this case, the people who expect to have a certain qualities of care that they don't perceive that they're getting. So.
To build on this conversation, particularly in the medical context, there's kind of this interesting tension at play, right? I think, Laura, you spoke about the tension between sort of the capitalist objective and the outcome of improving patient care. I completely agree that there is an inherent tension there. What I find fascinating is that the implementation of technology, particularly I'm thinking of electronic health records and how physicians have to, enter patient notes into these systems, produce metrics which sort of so standardized to the point that they can be thought of in terms of typical measures of efficiency, right? While sort of the broader objectives of both are inherently less reconcilable, I think it's really interesting how the ways in which technology attempts to treat work of perhaps a group of workers, physicians in this case, perhaps, in a way that makes them amenable to this broad standard sense of efficiency.
Yeah. Now, physicians are one thing, mental health professionals are another. There's going to be, certain, I mean, I don't want to belabor the medical example, but when we do think about some of those professional services that really are really, really difficult to reduce to a routine, those that are very, very much human dimension, to what extent would the introduction of these sort of ideas or whatever really interfere and with the ability to provide those types of services? I'm thinking mental health, I suppose law, or a lot of legal services sort of fall in that category. And a number of professional services sort of fall into that category. And at what point does that become intolerable? Because at the same time, again, AI potentially is seen as an enabler. Perhaps, and I don't want to constrain it to AI. It could be any sort of technology that provides access in some cases to people who otherwise might not have access to an actual practitioner. Perhaps a tension between using technology to provide greater access, to provide qualities of service that may not otherwise be possible, but at the same time running the risk of how, somebody being able to monitor it and recognize when it ceases being driven by effectiveness for the patient or the customer outcomes and becomes a victim of algorithmic intrusion.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can talk also on the worker side about how there's some tensions here, right? So I'm thinking about, going back to our gig work conversation. I'm thinking about how the de-skilling of gig work. If you spend some time in New York City, you'll notice a huge number of people who are very recent immigrants to the U.S. zipping around on bicycles delivering food, right? Many of them, if you have a delivery brought to your house and you try and talk to them, many of them don't speak English. And the reason that they have a job is because the work has been so de-skilled that it doesn't require any comprehension in the local language in order to do it effectively. So, of course, these are terrible exploitative jobs, right? This is not something that we should celebrate. On the other hand, it is creating opportunities for people who might be completely excluded from the, I would say, we can maybe say formal in quotation marks, workforce. I'm not sure how formal this in fact is, but, you know, more formal than purely informal work, right? So there are these double-edged swords, right, of expanding opportunity while reducing quality for on both the worker side and on the customer side, Tom, as you're saying.
And I think this speaks to sort of the inherent instability that I think emerging technologies exhibit, right? That the outcomes associated with the introduction of something like a digital platform for labor does not necessarily imply one fixed outcome, but are instead dependent on other factors, political factors, social factors, legal factors even. I'm thinking misclassification of gig work has been a topic for a number of years now, that all inform a particular outcome that we can observe.
And I guess this kind of brings up the main critique that I have against the book, but there is kind of a so what that this kind of a book sort of raises. I mean, in the appendix at the very, very end, he makes it very clear that his goal in writing the book was to raise, it was not to offer an alternative solution to capitalism per se, but to try to inspire a coordinated or a collective resistance against the system as it is. And quite a number of the works that we've done, not just in the program, but that I've read separately, sort of take the same approach when it comes to critiquing what is the entrenched status quo system that's in place. And I think a question that's starting to come to my mind in reading these is that, does anybody have a clear, coherent alternative that tries to get at some of the, you know, tries to correct some of the issues that Raverman, for example, is raising here, but also avoid some of the criticism, like, for example, with Marx and communism, which, you know, is not the sort of a solution that one would offer right now? What would a better alternative really look like that sort of addresses all of these things that Braverman offers? I know that's a huge question, but it's the one that I'm stuck with having read the book.
I mean, insofar as Braverman is a Marxist, I think Braverman's answer would be, there's nothing to be done within a capitalist framework. These are fundamental conflicts that are irreconcilable. I think the answer is there's nothing, Tom, that if you're really taking Braverman on his own terms, on the terms of Marxism, I think probably there's nothing that really addresses these problems. But I do think sort of within the capitalist system, taking that as a given, we can nonetheless ask what can be done by particular actors to mitigate these negative impacts, these degradations, right? And so it was actually one of the questions I was hoping to raise, you know, as somebody who teaches future managers, right? Braverman is saying that this problem is emanating from management, right? This is a problem of a management philosophy. So what can I teach these future managers in light of Braverman's argument if we want to somehow sort of curtail this degradation of labor, right? Not altogether eliminate the de-skilling effects of technological change in the attempt to control, but to improve the meaning and the quality of work nonetheless. So adding on to your question, Tom.
Yeah, that's a very well said. And I guess the question is, what resonates with these new managers that you've seen so far? Because obviously there are a lot of pressures to conform. Those pressures are ever present the moment that they walk out the door with their diplomas and go into the workforce. Mm-hmm. What do you think might resonate, or what has resonated?
Oh, you're throwing my question back at me?
Kind of. That's okay, Zach, if you want to jump in too, but I think
don't
since
teach
you're
managers yet, so
yeah, my own line of work is really different in that we're not teaching about management. We're teaching about professional, basically stewarding a profession. So some of these influences that we see are not as apparent, and it's sort of like, for us, it's sort of like a just due course. I mean, stewarding a profession is about, you know, maintaining domains of expert knowledge. Knowledge work can sometimes be marginalized compared to actually delivering the service. It's not quite the same thing as the level of financialism that these new managers are going to experience when they walk out the door.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't have an answer to the question. I mean, I can tell you that the way we try and teach our class, which is about how to manage the workforce, represents our best effort to try and tackle this, which is to say that, you know, it picks up on an old, you know, high road, low road distinction, and says you can, of course, try and squeeze every last drop of efficiency out of your workers, but that will produce problems, right? In a classic sort of Marxist framework, there will be problems that arise as a result of this effort in the form of alienation, disengagement, all sorts of, something as simple as turnover, something as straightforward as labor mobilization, right? These are all things that are going to arise predictably from efforts to sort of control and squeeze the workforce to the maximum extent. And so the alternative is to cultivate more of a partnership that empowers workers, gives them autonomy. When we think specifically about what this means for the implementation of new technologies, gives workers a say in how new technologies will be implemented rather than imposing them, allows them to help design and apply those technologies in ways that complement rather than replace their work. This, of course, is also a sort of moderating approach that tries to curb resistance and garner more consent, right? So it is not without problems from a sort of global perspective. But I think if we're focused on de-skilling and degradation specifically, right, it is an alternative management philosophy that says you as the management, as the representative of the capitalist class, won't necessarily get the most value from pursuing efficiency to its maximum extent. You might, in fact, be able to achieve more value through empowering the workforce. So that's the best effort we have that we sort of put forward in our class. I still get pushback from students who say, look, you're telling us that we should take on all these sort of like, you know, high performance work practices, high commitment work practices. But look at all these companies that treat their workers like absolute trash that are doing super well, right? Amazon thriving, right? And to that, you know, all you can say is like, you know, well, that's not the only way to be successful. But also my response tends to be, I don't have to teach a class in how to treat your workers badly. You can probably figure that out for yourself. If you want to pursue this alternative, that requires a little bit more instruction. And so that's the approach that we try and put forward in our class. Zach, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I mean, this is a fascinating line of questioning to go down on into, because it might, you know, become relevant for me soon. But I think the high road, low road distinction is an important one, because even, and you know, I don't think I agree with you, Laura, that you know, this would not be something that Braverman would at all agree with. But in response to sort of the students who come to you and say, well, look, Amazon's doing this thing, my initial reaction to that was kind of this, you know, responding to that with a, you're not going to be able to compete with Amazon strategically on anything like production or scale. And so in effect, something like taking the high road becomes itself a strategic choice that they can make to differentiate themselves from larger incumbents. And so, you know, it's a very opportunistic, I suppose, way to think about not treating workers like trash. But it is itself, I think, an important thing to recognize that maybe one of the reasons why Braverman is so salient today It's not just because we're academics studying work and studying technology, but it's also because this is felt throughout society, right? And these are worries that, you know, might be articulated in different ways, but are nonetheless felt. And so that itself becomes a selection criteria for people looking at what job they might go to next, right? What industries they might work in. This question of, will my work be automated, has almost no sure outcomes. And so I think that as these effects become more pronounced, selection on things like, do employees in this industry take the high road? Do they look out for their workers? Becomes even more and more important.
Yeah, and I really do like the high road, low road approach. I'm probably going to borrow it from you.
Not my term.
Okay. But the challenge is how to incorporate that into rewiring their perception of progress or measure, you know, how they measure themselves or their worth, where they stand or whatever. Because obviously, I think part of the challenges and the appeal of an Amazon, for example, is so easy to point to them and measure their success in terms of so many quantifiable things. And much of what the high road would suggest to me is a lot of qualitative things that are difficult to point to and say that is the measure of success, unless you have a case of somebody who, and I'm thinking about some time back, I was at a graduation. Somebody got a honorary doctorate of something or other because when their factory was on the verge of failure, the CEO took zero pay and made sure that the workers were still given some money or whatever, you know, did something very selfless and came forward. Usually about the only times you hear about those types of moves, human moves, are when it's so extreme, it becomes a story, not so much in like the day-to-day, how being taking the high road is of great benefit to the manager, the workers, and everybody around them. And it's a communication challenge because the rewards, incentives, and all of those things are just not geared towards promoting that sort of a thing. I'm not necessarily coming up with much in the way of answers either, but certainly there's, hopefully the more we discuss it, the more maybe we'll be able to figure out a system of rewards and incentives that go after the alternative that would be convincing to those entering into management, if that makes sense.
And I think it also informs maybe the way that we might think about technology and technology development, right? To not assume that automation necessarily has to result in the degradation of work itself, right? And mm-hmm. I think there's a path dependency that results in that being the case most of the time, but just being sensitized to that association could also help us break out of that path dependency, right? To explore ways in which expertise can be developed in other manners, to perhaps think about fulfillment at work and how that might shift with automation.
Great point. Special thanks to our guest, Zach Tan, for joining us in this episode. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.